Okay. So one of the important things Wittgenstein said about language is that it has its root in gesture, or as he also put it, in action, the deed, and more precisely, in reaction or instinct. What we call meaning, he writes, must be connected with the primitive language of gestures, a pointing language. Now this prompted Michael Tomasello, who's an eminent primatologist, to realize that contrary to current primatologist dogma, apes' gestures and not their vocalizations are the precursors of human language. As Wittgenstein says repeatedly and variously, our language games are grounded in instinct or primitive reactions, our shared primitive behavior. By this, he means things like spontaneous gestures, which through training get replaced by words. This, which John Canfield calls Wittgenstein's primitivism, contrasts with the unabashed intellectualism or mentalism of views like Chomsky's and Fodor's, according to which at the basis of language is a universal grammar or a language of thought, also called mentalese, located in the brain. On this view, our words are, as it were, informed by the brain. They get their meaning from what must be an inner full-blown referential language. Language acquisition is, according to them, primarily a problem of figuring out which mental concept a word maps onto or hooks onto. But Chomsky and Fodor's perpetually changing theories notwithstanding, progress away from that kind of referentialism has been made. Derek Montgomery, in his excellent paper, Mental Verbs and Semantic Development, shows how, drawing on Wittgenstein's private language argument, contemporary theories have been emphasizing semantic development as a process of learning how, when, and for what purpose words are used. He calls this the contextual view, which he summarizes as follows. These are all on your handout. The semantic development of mental verbs is better characterized as a process of learning how to use a word rather than a process of learning to label a referent. Meaning is not defined in the head of the word learner, but is embedded in the social practices responsible for framing the purpose a word serves and for guiding the proper ways to use it within relevant discourse contexts. Nor can an act of extension give meaning to an object or a sign, or produce criteria for the latter's further use. As Jerome Bruner writes, there is a long road between following somebody's gaze out to an object and being able to understand a referring expression like the cream cheese on the top shelf of the fridge. So it's in social practices, not in the brain, that we will find this long road to understanding. For it's in social practices that the meaning of words and the standards for their use are established. Meaning, as Wittgenstein says, is in use, out there, not in the head, not in some mental repository. In the Blue Book, Wittgenstein writes that the study of language games is the study of primitive forms of language or languages. Now, what are those primitive forms of language? They're not words or symbols, they're reactions. He writes, the origin and the primitive form of the language game is a reaction. Only from this can more complicated forms develop. Language, I want to say, is a refinement. In the beginning was the deed. The basic form of the game must be one in which we act. The essence of the language game is a practical method, a way of acting, not speculation, not chatter. So language then is a refinement. That means it emerges from the development of some of our natural reactions. Not just any natural reaction. Not singular or idiosyncratic reactions like tics, but our shared natural reactions. Wittgenstein suggests this when he writes in Cause and Effect, it is characteristic of our language that the foundation on which it grows consists in steady ways of living, regular ways of acting. So the kind of reaction from which language can develop must be the shared or instinctive behavior of mankind. Reactions such as crying when hurting or sad, smiling when happy, glad, jumping when startled, gasping or screaming when afraid. but also reacting to someone's suffering. Indeed, he writes, in its most primitive form, the language game is a reaction to somebody's cries and gestures, a reaction of sympathy or something of the sort. Now, these instinctive common reactions or action patterns are the prototypes of our concepts, including those of belief and doubt. As he writes, being sure that someone is in pain, doubting whether he is, and so on, or so many natural instinctive kinds of behavior towards other human beings. And our language is merely an auxiliary to and further extension of this relation. Our language game is an extension of primitive behavior. For our language game is behavior, instinct. And so the basis for the development of language is constituted by a number of distinct primitive instinctive behavioral patterns that John Canfield calls proto-language games. Without these behavioral patterns, like crying when sad and so on, there would be no language. This is the case phylogenetically as well as ontogenetically. So in the history of an individual as well as in the history of the human species. For these natural configurations of behavior, such as the natural untutored behavior of one pre-linguistic hominid helping another it sees is hurt, are part of the species inheritance. So that for Wittgenstein also, ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny, so they both sort of overlap in a way. In the investigations, Wittgenstein writes that the primitive forms of language are those used by the child when it is learning to talk, and that here, the teaching of language, I quote, is not explanation but training. Why? Well, for an obvious reason. Inasmuch as here, that is in initiate learning, or the learning of a first language, the initiate has only reactions and no words at its disposal. The learning of a native language has to do with action or behavior. Words can only play a secondary, like a kind of background music role. This is why at the very beginning, where the teacher has only the infant's instinct to work with, the teaching of language can only be a training and not an explaining. Language cannot take its grounding in thought or reflection. Again, Wittgenstein, I really want to say that scruples in thinking begin with, have their roots in instinct. Or again, a language game does not have its origin in reflection. Reflection is part of a language game. I want to regard man here as an animal, as a primitive being to which one grants instinct but not ratiocination, as a creature in a primitive state. Language did not emerge from some kind of ratiocination. So, because it has reactions and no words, the preverbal child is much like an animal. And so the kind of training it will have to undergo resembles that affected on animals. It resembles taming, abrichten. I am using the word train, writes Wittgenstein, in a way strictly analogous to that in which we talk of an animal being trained to do certain things. It is done by means of example, reward, punishment, and such like. Language, then, it is an extension of our pattern non-linguistic behavior through training. But, asks Wittgenstein in the investigations, how is the connection between the name and the thing set up? And he replies, I quote, this question is the same as, how does a human being learn the meaning of the names of sensations? Of the word pain, for example. Here is one possibility. Words are connected with the primitive, the natural expressions of the sensation, and used in their place. A child has hurt himself and he cries. And then adults talk to him and teach him exclamations and later sentences. They teach the child new pain behavior. So the connection between the name and the thing is not made by an act of extension, not by merely hooking gestures onto their public reference, but by processes of drill or habituation that are similar to stimulus-response conditioning. But that must be supplemented by training into the practice in which those words are used. So what the child is taught in learning to replace his primitive reactions with words is new behavior, writes Wittgenstein. Natural reactions are replaced by modified action patterns, a stylized overlay on the prior naturally existing interaction pattern. So for instance, the child learns to replace his initial crying for food with intentional gesturing for food, and eventually with more sophisticated, that is, linguistic requests. The word replaces the gesture and takes over its function. Now, it isn't that the word is now hooked on or mapped onto the behavior, but that it replaces it. In first picking up the linguistic expression, the child is not describing with it or referring with it, but reacting with it in first picking it up. And Wittgenstein's right. So you are saying that the word pain really means crying? On the contrary, the verbal expression of pain, and here's Ausdruck, so that kind of expression, replaces crying and doesn't describe it. So on what Montgomery calls the contextualist view of semantic development, this substitutive function of the word, it's doing the same job as the gesture, is due to the continuity that exists between the communicative goals children have pre-linguistically and the goals they have when using words. But we have to be careful here of Montgomery's over-intellectualization of the primitive gesture that will extend into language. There can hardly be a communicative goal at the initial stage. Indeed, Wittgenstein speaks of a reaction at the basis of the language game, and that implies spontaneity, not purpose or goal-directedness. The infant's primitive crying is not goal-directed, but instinctively expressive. Now, of course, the infant will soon learn to direct or stage its crying to serve a purpose, but that is what Wittgenstein calls a refinement of the primitive gesture. So that, contra Montgomery, at the root of language is not pre-linguistic social communicative behavior, but pre-linguistic behavior tout court. The primitive gesture is only expressive, not expressly communicative or social. It will gradually become a tool for intentional communication, and it will also be replaced by language. Now, of course, that's not to say that we lose all gestures to language. Gestures remain, but they are no longer our only mode of expression. And the uses of gestures become as various as the uses of language. In the main, those delineated by Karl Bühler, they are descriptive, expressive, and directive, steering or signaling. So, ostensive teaching, as opposed to mere ostensive definition, involves behavioral conditioning. The child is taught through repetition exercises to utter certain words in certain contexts or situations. These drills are used to tap and channel the child's natural reactions. What we witness in these initial stages is not yet language, but, writes Wittgenstein, processes resembling language, PI7. For a language is not the mere repetition of certain sounds in certain contexts and after certain prompts. Wittgenstein is not a behaviorist. Drill is not enough. Beyond mere conditioning, a normative attitude towards utterances, towards how things are to be done, must be inculcated in the child so that it can learn to regulate itself. And acquiring a normative attitude demands nothing less than being enculturated. It is thanks to her acquiring this normative attitude that the child is eventually able to go on her own, to proceed from other regulation to self-regulation. Successful enculturation means the child can then judge for herself that in a particular instance, a word or phrase makes sense. Not by comparing it to a benchmark context-free use, but on the basis of her experience of multiple language games in which the word or phrase is used. So for Wittgenstein, the acquisition of language is the acquisition of a technique or capacity. And capacities are flexible to individual and occasion. They allow for, indeed are basic to, productivity and creativity. We were talking about that yesterday. So that, contra Chomsky and Fodor, the learning of a first language is essentially social. It requires that at least one member of the child's linguistic community mold its primitive reactions in proto-language games into language games, bringing the child through a process of enculturation to assimilate, conform to, and apply the standards of correctness of its linguistic community. Now, lest this normalization of the child be deemed un-Wittgensteinian, I should add that Wittgenstein refers to, and quite often, to a normal way of doing things and of using words. In the lectures on philosophical psychology, for instance, he writes, having been taught, the child must use the word in a normal way. More on this later, we'll come back. Now, acquiring language is like learning to walk. The child is stepped into language by an initiator, and after much hesitation and repeated faltering, with time, multifarious practice and repeated exposure, it can disengage itself from its teacher's hold and is able, as it were, to run with the language. So now just the two problems of language acquisition. I'll quickly describe them. The two main problems of native language acquisition, as I have found them in the literature, non-Wittgensteinian literature, are the problem of learning what is being taught and the problem of productivity of new sentences. Fodor's and Chomsky's solution to both these problems is to posit an innate language of thought or a language organ or universal grammar that enables learning and productivity, according to them. So I briefly summarize their approach to these problems and then show that the Wittgensteinian solution also appeals to a grammar, but of a different kind. So the problem of learning is summarized in one of Fodor's hallmark claims. I quote, one cannot learn a language unless one has a language. How can a child understand words or sentences we're trying to teach it if it has no language at its disposal? That's what he asks. On Chomsky's view, the child could not make sense of the language it is being taught if it didn't have an innate language acquisition device, LAD, LAD, with which to recognize, interpret, and analyze that language. Knowledge of language, according to Chomsky, is based on a core set of principles embodied in all languages and stored somewhere, he doesn't know where, in the brain, in the mind-brain, what he calls, for him they're synonymous, of every human being. Universal grammar consists of this fixed system of principles that apply to all external or natural languages, such as English, Greek, Hebrew, and so on. And it also consists of an array of parameters whose settings vary between languages. Chomsky's requirements for learning a human language are to be human and to have the minimal exposure to language evidence necessary to trigger the various parameters of universal grammar, which is in the brain. This innate universal grammar enables the child to abstract or infer the correct structure or rules of its native language from its limited and faulty manifestations that it's exposed to. So that for Chomsky, language acquisition consists in the gradual, experience-triggered disclosure of innate grammar. It is a process of parameter setting which results in the child's acquisition of the correct structure of her native language. Now, an immediate objection is that this may at best offer an explanation of how the child comes to learn what the correct structure or syntax of its native regional language. But what about its meaning? The difficulty was well illustrated by Searle's Chinese Room argument, according to which competence with syntax doesn't imply understanding. And then Putnam later comes to show that we can't even do the syntax if we haven't first got the understanding. But Chomsky tries to appeal to this, to import meaning into this deficient scenario by appealing to deep structures. But we're not going to go into that. Let's move on to Fodor. Taking Chomsky's lead, Jerry Fodor claims that language acquisition requires that we already possess a language of thought, LOT, L-O-T, LOT. That is an inner language that contains all the concepts or representations of anything we can ever learn, think, or express. It is, according to him, by successfully matching words or concepts it encounters in experience with concepts or physical meanings already present in the language of thought that the child comes to acquire language. The language of thought, that is, provides meaning itself. Indeed, in his latest revision of his position, Locke 2, The Language of Thought Revisited, Fodor is blunt. He writes, concept learning is an oxymoron. So the core assumption being that you can't learn a concept unless you already have that concept. There is something radically incoherent, he writes, about the thesis that concepts can be learned. Because if learning, say, the concept green, is coming to believe that green applies to all and only green things, how could anyone who lacked the concept green believe this? How could they so much as contemplate believing this? And so on pain of circularity, coming to believe this can't be the process by which green is acquired. This new Fodor, however, has come to recognize the compellingness of a link between our concepts and the world. And he asks, how is it that so many of our concepts fit the world? Why do so many of our concepts have instances? A nativist with any sort of conscience must confront this question. And so he concedes that the unlearnability of concepts does not entail their innateness. Not, that is, if innate means something like not acquired in consequence of experience. But if acquired in consequence of experience, and yet not through learning, then how are concepts acquired? Fodor's answer, by acquisition. He distinguishes concept acquisition from concept learning, the latter being only a species of the former. It's through our learning of stereotypes that the brain acquires a concept. So that concept acquisition is a neurological process, and it is from our brain that we acquire concepts. We don't learn them from the world at all, but from our brain. My brain acquires concepts from the world, and I acquire them from my brain. Now, it's going to take a lot of time for Fodor's updated theory to be digested, providing it is digestible at all. He himself admits that it doesn't amount to more than a sketch of the relevant geography. And a lot of commentators on Locke 2 agree that Fodor is starting to lose it a little bit. Now, very quickly, the problem of productivity. The problem of productivity or creativity is how to account for our capacity to produce and understand a potentially infinite number of novel and correct sentences. Here, what is called the poverty of stimulus argument strikes at social theories of language acquisition by claiming that the utterances encountered by the child in experience are too limited. Chomsky is no longer concerned with the degeneracy of the data, but only its poverty or meagerness, because it's been shown that the data is not that degenerate, that actually there is only about one in every 1,500 utterances addressed to children that is faulty. Some experiments have shown that, or research has shown that. So he's given up the degeneracy. So it's only poverty. So how is then the child, in his experience, are too limited for it to be possible that the child learn the language by generalizing from this experience? Moreover, the syntax of any language is so abstruse that no child could learn it, he says, unless she already had the form of the grammar hardwired into her brain. Because, on Chomsky's view, experience cannot account for our ability to understand and produce novel correct sentences, we are forced to suppose the existence of a universal grammar, which must be both endowed with recursive rules that enable productivity or creativity, and it has to be innate, for we could never acquire it from exposure to limited and imperfect language use. Now, it's sometimes difficult to pick out what Chomsky is faulting. Not only because his views have changed considerably over the years, but because of his lack of clarity. In speaking of language acquisition, Chomsky sometimes speaks of language being acquired, but other times of principles being acquired. So when he claims children are seldom corrected by parents, one might easily disagree. But it is more difficult to disagree with the view that parents do not teach children linguistic principles, which leads Chomsky to conclude that these have to be innate. But note that the problematic implication in this claim is that it is necessary to know the principles of language in order to acquire a language, which explains why Chomsky insists that the learning of a language is not like learning how to ride a bike or how to cook. For he then have to say we need to know the principles of bike riding before we can learn to ride a bike. Actually, Chomsky claims that language acquisition is more akin to growing than to learning. He writes, in certain fundamental respects, we do not really learn language. Rather, grammar grows in the mind. Chomsky doesn't deny that exposure. He stopped denying that exposure to language or language evidence is crucial to the process of acquisition. He doesn't deny that. For children to be able to build up pragmatic competence, as opposed to grammatical competence, which is a cognitive state that's abstract and independent of use or situation. So, in order to be able to build a pragmatic competence, they need to hear language and use. And so he concedes, I quote, it would not be at all surprising to find that normal language learning requires use of language in real-life situations in some way, end of quote. But the principles of universal grammar are incapable of being learned by social interaction, and therefore language, according to him, is incapable of being acquired by social interaction. And if no principles, no language. But what I want to claim is that this principle requirement is at best an unnecessary, at worst an illogical imposition on the possibility of language acquisition. As we saw earlier, language is rooted in gesture, in action, not in principles or in inference, abstraction, or analysis. Of course, it isn't possible to acquire the principles of language if we don't have a language, but this doesn't imply that principles are innate. It simply shows they're irrelevant to language acquisition. We don't need to know the location principle or any other Chomskyan universal grammar principle in order to acquire a language. Stipulating a principle requirement creates a problem where none is there, and appealing to innateness fabricates a solution where none was needed. So now I'd like to introduce Wittgenstein's social conception of language acquisition as a reply to these. From Wittgenstein's social view of language acquisition, the problem of learning is readily deproblematized. The children doesn't need to already have a language in order to learn a language. What it needs is to be in a situation in which there is already language, but it isn't yet the child's, and to have human instincts and reactions, as well as a carer who can train it into developing those instinctive reactions into words. So we might substitute Fodor's "one cannot learn a language unless one has a language" with "one cannot learn a language unless there is already a language there." And in the case of the first human language, there was no learning a language, but an evolving into language from shared natural reactions. So the problem of learning, as articulated by both Chomsky and Fodor, is another non-problem. The claim that the initiate must already have, at least in some form of capacity, the concept it is trying to acquire, inasmuch as acquiring it requires the ability to discriminate between what belongs to the concept and what doesn't, that claim might have some kind of pull if we didn't have at our disposal more obvious means by which discrimination is enabled in the initiate, such as the transmission of criteria through guidance, training, teaching, and repeated exposure. We needn't already have the concept green in order to learn how to apply green to green things. We need only be repeatedly guided and or exposed to the use of the word in various contexts. Of course, time and experience are required here, and this is why we rightly speak of concept formation. Also, the related claim that the initiate must already have a language if she is to understand what she is being taught would be admissible if the only tools of transmission at the teacher's disposal from the very beginning, from the get-go, were language in all its complexity. If all the teacher had were complete sentences unintelligible to the child. But that's not the case. In early initiate teaching, the teacher doesn't use fully fledged language, but the bare rudiments of language. And her teaching consists not only in the use of words, but more importantly at this stage, in contextualized actions, gestures, facial expressions, tones, and so on. Moreover, the child's understanding is not achieved immediately, but requires multifarious repetition in multifarious contexts. So why would a language of thought be required at all from the get-go? As to the grammar necessary for language acquisition, it does not need to be already in place in the initiate. It simply needs to be in place in her environment. The initiate doesn't need to have prior knowledge of the type she is learning, i.e. of language. She need only be properly equipped to learn it. By that is meant, she must be a biologically and socially adept human being living in a human world. So on a Wittgensteinian conception, the necessary conditions for initiate language acquisition include the following: that a fully fledged language be there, and that it be used by the carer in training the child, that the child have natural reactions that it shares with the rest of humanity, including, as we saw, shared instinctive behavior, crying when hurting or sad, but also shared instinctive responses to pain, to pointing, and shared basic discriminations, for example, of taste, colors, and shapes. Indeed, our acquiring concepts such as pain requires that we have appropriate, i.e. normal, human reactions. Wittgenstein writes, If a child looked radiant when it was hurt and shrieked for no apparent reason, one couldn't teach him to use the word pain. Even if we taught him to use it instead of shrieking, it would still not have the consequences like taking him to the doctor. It would be a new use. One couldn't teach him or use the psychological words. The frame of reference to which we fasten these words is ordinary human behavior. The further away a human being is from this, the less we could know how to teach him. And for concept acquisition to even get off the ground, the initiate must be susceptible to training, must react to such things as pointing and encouragement appropriately. He writes, acts of encouragement will only be possible if the pupil responds and responds in a particular way. Imagine the gestures, sounds of encouragement you use when you teach a dog to retrieve. Imagine, on the other hand, that you try to teach a cat to retrieve. As the cat will not respond to your encouragement, most of the acts of encouragement which you perform when you train the dog are here out of the question. Also, thirdly, a fundamental trust on the part of the initiate is also required for language acquisition. Her blind acceptance of the authority of the teacher or of the rule. In Uncertainty, Wittgenstein insists on the blind trust that must lie at the bottom of the learning process if that process is to go on at all. He writes, the child learns by believing the adult. Doubt comes after belief. For how can a child immediately doubt what it is taught? That could only mean that if he was incapable of learning certain language games. A child learns there are reliable and unreliable informants much later than it learns facts which are told it. So that's not to say that children won't often inquire about what they're taught, but that children do not normally question the teacher's authority or the basic rules of fact that they are taught, for example, the multiplication tables, the letters of the alphabet, that Napoleon existed, that Paris is the capital of France, what some words mean. Alexander Bain speaks of what he calls the natural or primitive credulity of the mind. He writes, we are all faced at the outset. We become skeptics by experience, that is, by encountering checks and exceptions. We begin with unbounded credulity. That could actually be a good epigraph for Uncertainty. And of course, this is helped by the fact that we are first taught the use of a word in its most obvious or unambiguous context. As Wittgenstein writes, the way in which we learn to use the word pain, and therefore the way in which it is used, is complicated, difficult to describe. For instance, it is first taught under certain circumstances where there is no doubt, where there is no question of doubt. And in the Blue Book, we're reminded that language in its simplest form stems from activities, reactions which are clear-cut and transparent, quote unquote. And finally, an important condition for language acquisition would go under the broad heading of training and include drill, repeated exposure, as well as a competent trainer, that is, a reasonably adept use of the language, endowed with enough pedagogic ability to mold or shape the child's responses to the training so that they end up in harmony with the norm. Now here it may be argued that deliberate training is not necessary for language acquisition and that exposure to a language may be sufficient. What Philippe Narbou's view is that training is a necessary, though insufficient condition for the learning of a native language, whereas second language acquisition doesn't require it and can rely on nothing other than ostensive definition because it relies on previous training. So, you know, that's an open question. We can talk about that. So these conditions then, and there are others we can add have come after Wittgenstein, such as norm hungriness that the animals don't have and that human beings have. There are also conditions for acquisition of language, or the capacity for joint triadic attention, the capacity and motivation humans have for explicit teaching, which animals don't have. Things like that have been added to so it's a more empirical study that have been added to, that can be added to the conditions at Wittgenstein's, or that can actually just simply be specifications of what Wittgenstein has generally claimed. So these conditions, then, in stark contrast with Chomsky's picture of native language acquisition, where the child is on her own, having to construct language for herself from the meager data available to her, unpropelled by correction or reinforcement. So Patchett, Chomsky, and Fodor, the human brain, though of course it's biologically necessary to language acquisition, nobody's denying that, is not the repository of language or of meaning. Meanings are established outside the individual mind, and so their acquisition requires sociolinguistic interaction. The grammatical rules that establish criteria for the proper uses of words are not internally or privately applied principles. They are norms or conventions applied and regulated by a linguistic community and transmissible only through enculturation. This makes language acquisition internally related to learning, exposure, and initiation into normative practices. So Wittgenstein, Wittgensteinian grammar. As Christina Ernelling writes, communicating requires something beyond the speaker's subjective private mental state. It requires an objective and intersubjective framework which the speakers share. Now, Wittgenstein never denied that an objective and intersubjective framework is needed for language to be possible. And he certainly never denied that language or communicating depends on grammar, keeping in mind Wittgenstein's somewhat idiosyncratic use of grammar as the network of conventional rules that describe what it makes or doesn't make sense to say in a particular language. Wittgenstein never stopped reflecting on the nature and extension of grammar, and his last word on the subject appears in his last work, On Certainty. The Wittgensteinian solution to the two problems of language acquisition is not as foreign to Fodor and Chomsky's as may be supposed, for he too posits the existence of a universal grammar. But Wittgenstein's grammar has nothing of the mental about it. It is neither innate nor inner. It is, like language, rooted in our primitive reactions and transmitted socioculturally, both explicitly through heuristic means and implicitly through exposure to and practice of the language. So let's see then how this universal grammar is linked to those very general facts of nature that lie at the foundation of language. Our grammar, Wittgenstein likes to say, is autonomous. By this, he doesn't mean that it has no link with reality, but that it is not, as he writes, answerable to any reality or accountable to any reality. What he means is that grammatical rules are not rationally justified by reference to anything empirical. The relation between grammatical rules and reality is not a rational one. We can neither justify nor invalidate a grammatical rule empirically. The rule of grammar, red is darker than pink, is not a conclusion we come to from observing colors, but a description of the way we use the terms red, darker than, and pink, according to which if I were to say, I'll wear the pink dress rather than the red, dark colors suit me better, I would not be speaking grammatically. So what truck, then, do some rules of grammar have with reality, besides the fact that people use them? It's mostly in uncertainty that Wittgenstein addresses the question. Here he comes to realize that many of the sentences that we usually take to be empirical or epistemic conclusion, such as here is a hand, the world exists, I have parents, cats don't grow on trees, are in fact expressions of rules of grammar or rules of thought. Their link with reality is not rational but causal. Causal in the sense of conditioned as opposed to reasoned. Let me just try to explain. Our language games are conditioned by the world we live in, indeed by regularities in the world, he writes in PI, page 230, by very general facts of nature. But this draws a causal connection, not a justificatory one. He writes, I cannot say that I have good grounds for the opinion that cats do not grow on trees, that I had a father and a mother. A fact, then, may be at the origin of a grammatical rule, but it will have been transformed into a rule as a result of conditioning and not reasoning. Repeated exposure will have, as it were, hammered the fact into the foundations of our language. He writes on OC558, we say we know that water boils and doesn't freeze under such and such circumstances. Is it conceivable that we're wrong? Wouldn't a mistake topple all judgment with it? More, what could stand if that were to fall? Might someone discover something that might say it was a mistake? Whatever may happen in the future, however water may behave in the future, we know, in italics, it's not really knowing, he puts that in italics, that up to now, so we're certain, that up to now it has behaved thus in innumerable instances. This fact is fused, eingegossen, into the foundations of our language game. So some facts have been fused into bedrock, that become part of our conceptual scaffolding. Wittgenstein's image of a fact being fused into or infused or cast in or poured into our foundations is deliberate and crucial. It reminds us that many conceptual necessities are related to facts or a posteriori discoveries, but that these facts have become part of our foundational grammatical bedrock through a non-epistemic process, like repeated exposure or training. Though our initial awareness of them might have been epistemic or empirical. So essentially, Wittgenstein is saying, before Kripke, that some of our conceptual necessities have their origin in a posteriori discoveries. As Ram Hare explains, it is contingent that any man is a father, but conceptually necessary that being a father he has or has had a child. But that conceptual necessity is a reflection of the natural necessity of the father's role in the reproductive process, a role not known to some Aboriginal tribes even in historical times. The conceptual necessity has come into being in response to an a posteriori discovery of the natural necessity of the father's role. But so deeply has this conceptual necessity become embedded in the language, we forget that it has its source in an a posteriori discovery. So the term embedded that Hare uses here, like fused, is meant to convey that non-ratiocinated manner in which a posteriori conclusions have infiltrated our language games. The terms call to mind others which Wittgenstein uses when he wants to avoid reference to an epistemic or rational assimilation. He speaks of conditioned, of swallowing or absorption, and he also speaks of some propositions hardening into rules. Indeed, that infiltration or assimilation be non-ratiocinated is essential if grammar is to be autonomous or objective. A rule of grammar is not answerable to reality, but it is assumed in all our language games about reality, in all we can say or ask about reality. It's part of the unquestioned framework that allows us to form our hypotheses, our questions and answers about reality. It is anchored in all my questions and answers, he writes, so anchored that I cannot touch it. So to say that grammar is autonomous is to say that it is not justifiable by empirical facts or established by decision, and therefore to recognize its objectivity. If grammatical rules are the product of agreement, it is not a concerted or deliberate agreement, what Wittgenstein calls a peaceful agreement, an agreement in form of life, essentially a blind agreement in our shared natural behavior and human practices. It is this consensus of action, quote, a consensus of doing the same thing, reacting in the same way, that is at the normative root of our grammar and our concepts. We might say that it is this shared sense of the obvious in our form of life that grammatical or normative propositions formulate. So that where our rules of grammar have their root in facts, their anchorage is affected in and through practice, not decision. The objectivity or autonomy of grammatical rules is guaranteed by the blindness with which they are intersubjectively established and followed. So in uncertainty, Wittgenstein realizes how much more far-reaching grammar is than he previously thought. It includes certainties of our world picture, which, when formulated, resemble empirical and contingent propositions. He writes, I want to say propositions of the form of empirical propositions, and not only propositions of logic, form the foundation of all operating with thoughts, with language. If I say we assume that the earth has existed for many years past, or something similar, then of course it sounds strange that we should assume such a thing. But in the entire system of our language games, it belongs to the foundations. The assumptions, one might say, forms the basis of action and therefore naturally of thought. So these propositions that resemble or of the form of, yet are not in fact empirical epistemic propositions and epistemic are propositions that we affirm without special testing. Propositions, that is, which have a peculiar logical role, he writes, in the system of our empirical propositions. In fact, rules of grammar. They can be, and here I've just done a taxonomy, which is different from the one I mentioned yesterday, but again, drawn from uncertainty. So these rules of grammar, these certainties that were once learned as empirical or epistemic propositions, but have become so intersubjectively ingrained and fossilized that they're no longer part of the wealth of empirical or epistemic propositions of a given community. So the earth is round, trains arrive in train stations, human beings can go to the moon. These also certainties that we may have learned as children, but that we've learned as rules, not as questionable empirical facts. Babies cannot speak, people die, people sometimes lie. certainties then also that may never have been expressed or taught. These are either lived certainties or certainties that are assimilated through repeated exposure. So, I have a body. That's a lived certainty. Never did anyone have to teach me, except the word body. That's something else, that I have a body. There exist people other than myself. The world exists. The earth is a large body, and so on. So the basic certainties listed in the last two groups, second and third group, can be called universal certainties or universal rules of grammar, in that they belong to the scaffolding of thought of any normal human being. They're rules of grammar that are rooted non-ratiocinatively in very general facts of nature appertaining to the natural history of human beings. Any empirical inquiry has to take such universal rules of grammar as the world exists, human beings live and die, newborn babies cannot speak, as part of its logical or grammatical starting points, as part of its grammar. So that language builds on reflexive gestures as well as on lived and acquired certainties, which in fact hardly differ from reflexive gestures and function like grammatical rules. They condition our use of language, they determine meaning. Wittgenstein's grammar, a partly universal grammar, replaces Chomsky's. But where Chomsky's universal grammar is in the head, Wittgenstein's grammar is external and does not consist of symbols or structures. It's actually nothing really but a way of acting, a logic in action. As he writes, giving grounds, justifying the evidence comes to an end. But the end is not certain propositions striking us immediately as true. It's not a kind of seeing on our part. It is our acting which lies at the bottom of the language game. That is, though we can formulate our rules of grammar, as I've been doing and as Wittgenstein often does, this formulation or verbalization is always merely heuristic. An expression of a rule of grammar is never an occurrence of the mastery of that rule. Our mastery of grammar cannot be meaningfully expressed in the flow of the language game. It can only show itself in what we do and in what we say. So, for example, my mastery of the grammatical rule, there exists being other than myself, beings other than myself, shows itself in my speaking to others or of others. And Wittgenstein often speaks of language mastery in terms of a know-how, of being able to do certain things, to make acceptable moves in the language game. He writes, understanding a word may mean knowing how it is used, being able to apply it, and so on. I'll let you read the others. He also calls the acquisition of language the acquisition of a capacity. He writes, when he first learns the names of colors, what is taught the child? Well, he learns to call out red on seeing something red. What I teach him must be a capacity, so he can now bring something red at an order or arrange objects according to color. So we've come full circle back into the realm of action, and rightly so, for the primitivity of the deed of action is not only anthropological but logical. When Wittgenstein writes that the basic form of the game must be one in which we act, he is not only talking about the primitivity of action in the acquisition of language, but in the possibility of language. It is our acting which lies at the bottom of the language game. And so now, 3 minutes more, very briefly to the productivity problem. How are we able, according to Wittgenstein, to extend our limited acquired knowledge of language to new situations and contexts? Well, Wittgenstein's answer to that is that the teaching of language is not a teaching of definitions, but the transmission of a technique. To understand a language, he writes, means to be master of a technique, and that it does not aim for total regulation, but for self-regulation. So Wittgenstein didn't disparage the use of ostensive definition in teaching. He did, however, stress its limitations. Teaching, which is not meant to apply to anything but the examples given, is different from that which points beyond them. Indeed, Wittgenstein's rule following argument shows precisely that generating new sentences is nothing but an instance of knowing how to go on, how to extend the speech that we have into new contexts. Criteria determine whether a speaker is following a rule or using a word in accordance with the norm that is being inculcated. These criteria are public, not private. They can be transmitted to the child and invoked to guide and correct him in his attempts to use the words he's being taught. The child's various attempts are guided, they're encouraged and discouraged, until enough training allows her to grasp what sorts of contexts are propitious for the use of the word. semantic development involves precisely becoming increasingly sensitive to how characteristics of different contexts constrain the words we can use. However, though constraint is necessary, there is no exhaustive determination of use, but an indication of proper use. So I would say the use is constrained, not shackled. And that allows for and explains creativity and productivity. We might make here an analogy with a dog that is trained not to bite. The dog will not only not bite the people present during the training, but not bite in all similar contexts, example, unthreatening contexts. Or again, when the child is taught to open a door, she doesn't just learn to open that white single panel door which her mother is using to teach her, but all doors that she will come across and experience, whether they be white, black, double paneled, and so on. So productivity or creativity is possible inasmuch as rules are seen to be mere enablers of meaningful language. Grammatical rules don't completely convey or circumscribe use. They are standards of use. Wittgenstein speaks here of a rough regularity in our use of words, so that meaning can be guided by specific rules and yet apply and be seen to apply to new instances. Grammatical rules are mere tools with which we can build a countless number of meaningful sentences. Wittgenstein's answer to the productivity problem is encapsulated in this passage. Yes, there is a great thing about language, that we can do what we haven't learned. So communication, objectivity, and constancy of meaning are made possible by a grammar, but that grammar is not innate, it is transmitted. It is social training, not a language of thought, that makes language possible, prevents communication from breaking down, and allows for the production of novel, meaningful sentences. As Wittgenstein writes, it is the system of language that makes the sentence a thought and makes it a thought for us. So if universality or uniformity is the motivating force behind nativism, I think there is in our shared instinctive and second nature reactions universality and uniformity enough. We need no mental universal grammar to serve as the shared basis from which language, our language games, can be acquired. It is to the stream of life that we must go to find the bedrock of our language, or what Wittgenstein calls the riverbed of thought, as well as its fluid and ever-changing waters. Language is internally connected to life and action. This is what Wittgenstein's concept of the language game conveys. At the root of language is a non-linguistic framework of shared instinctive reactions, shared genetic makeup, and a good dose of sociocultural interaction. For Wittgenstein, our language could not mean independently of the context of our individual acts, of our cultural traditions, or our human forms of life. Words have meaning only in the stream of life, he writes. Fodor's and Chomsky's failure to grasp the essentially contextualized nature of language is a major failure to appreciate the importance of language as a repository of our human form of life. And so to Fodor's, one cannot learn a language unless one has a language, I am always tempted to reply, get a life.